to Sri Guru and Gauranga, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sahib Relation Mati Bhakti Nata Swami Namo Namaste Saraswati Devi Gavani Pachani Vasayasa Sanyari Pasadhyay Visitarani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Jagapadakamabhan Sri Guru Vaishnavastra Sri Rupam Sahagrajatam Sahagunaranam Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvudutam Krishna Saita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vikamstra Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
This was April 8th, 2009, here in Auckland. And we're reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, from text 18. To 35. So if we could just read the English together. Starting with 18. Okay. 13, 18. Everybody ready?
Yes.
He is a source of light in all luminous objects. He is beyond the darkness of matter and is unmanifested. He is knowledge. He is the object of knowledge and he is the goal of knowledge. He is situated in everyone's heart. Thus the field of activities, the body, knowledge, and the knowable have been summarily described by me. Only my devotees can understand this thoroughly and thus attain to my nature. Material nature and the living entities should be understood to be beginningless. Their transformations and the modes of matter are products of material nature. Nature is said to be the cause of all material causes and effects, whereas the living entity is the cause of the various sufferings and enjoyments in this world. The living entity in material nature just follows the ways of life, enjoying the three modes of nature. This is due to his association with that material nature. Thus he meets with good and evil among various species. Yet in this body there is another, a transcendental enjoyer, who is the Lord, the supreme proprietor, who exists as the overseer and permitter, and who is known as the Supersoul. One who understands this philosophy concerning material nature, the living entity, and the interaction of the modes of material nature is sure to obtain liberation. He will not take birth here again, regardless of his present condition. Some perceive the Supersoul within themselves through meditation, others through the cultivation of knowledge, and still others through working without fruit of desires. Again, there are those who, although not conversant in spiritual knowledge, begin to worship the Supreme Person upon hearing about him from others. Because of their tendency to hear from authorities, they also transcend the path of birth and death. O chief of the Bharatas, know that whatever you see in existence, both the moving and the non-moving, is only the combination of the field of activities and the knower of the field. One who sees the Supersoul accompanying the individual soul in all bodies and who understands that neither the soul nor the Supersoul within the destructible body is ever destroyed actually sees. One who sees the Supersoul equally present everywhere in every living being does not degrade himself by his mind. Thus he approaches the transcendental destination. One who can see that all activities are performed by the body, which is created of material nature, and sees that the self does nothing, actually sees. When a sensible man ceases to see different identities due to different material bodies, when he sees how beings are expanded everywhere, he attains the Brahman conception. Those with a vision of eternity can see that the imperishable soul is transcendental, eternal, and beyond the modes of nature. Despite contact with the material body, O Arjuna, the soul neither does anything nor is entangled. The sky, due to its subtle nature, does not mix with anything, although it is all-pervading. Similarly, the soul situated in Brahman vision does not mix with the body, though situated in that body. O son of Bharata, as the sun alone illuminates all this universe, so does the living entity, one within the body, illuminate the entire body by consciousness. Those who see with eyes of knowledge the difference between the body and the knower of the body can also understand the process of liberation from bondage and material nature attained to the supreme goal. So basically, this is talking about that there's the body, the soul, and the supersoul. The body is composed of material nature according to the desire of the living entity. So the living entity desires to be in rebellious mood towards Krishna and is actually making that decision, Prabhupada says, continually. So moment to moment to moment. It's not just that we made some decision at some point far away in time and now we're really surrendered. But moment to moment, we're desiring to be in illusion. And therefore, Krishna supplies our desires by giving us a suitable body. But we are not this body. And in fact, it says here that we're not even doing the activities of the body. We're not sitting, we're not drinking herbal tea, we're not holding a book, we're just witnessing these things. We're not affected really by the body, we're not entangled in the body, we're not doing any of the things in the body, we're just simply a witness. And the ultimate witness is the super soul. So that's the overall theme of this chapter. And one who understands these things, I understand these things means that you realize them, not just that it's some interesting philosophy that you accept theoretically and can explain. But once we realize that, we don't need to take birth again. We become detached from the material world. So I asked each of you to bring to this class hopefully two things, something that you really liked about this section and something you had a question about. Did you do that? Did everybody do that? I hope so. Okay. I hope we brought at least one. Preferably, I'd like you to have something that was your favorite and something you had a question about. So I'm going to do my best. I'm not very good at doing that, but I'm going to do my best to try to go through this quickly, and then I'll deal with all of your points. Okay, going to text 18. Here, Prabhupada is talking about the difference between the soul and the super soul, and that's one point Prabhupada's making over and over and over again in this chapter. We are not God. The soul is 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 not God. So he's saying this because obviously there are a lot of impersonalists who read this chapter of Bhagavad Gita and say that the soul is God. It's a good idea if you have to deal with such people to go through this chapter and see all of the arguments that Prabhupada makes. And one of the main arguments he makes here is that the soul doesn't have his arms and legs everywhere and isn't conscious of everything. I don't have my arms and legs everywhere. I have them right here, and that's it. And I have no idea what you guys are thinking. And even if I had some mystic power and I could tell what you were thinking, I don't know what everybody's thinking all over the universe. Even people who have mystic power and can pick up on your feelings and your motives, they're not conscious of every blade of grass in Algeria. So that's God. God is aware of, you know, all the little microbes in this room and the little spiders and the ants and what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what their desire is. Okay? Text 19, Prabhupada says, the monists say at the ultimate stage these three items become one. The three items are the knower, the process of knowing, and knowledge. So the knower is us. The process of knowledge was discussed in text 8 through 12 in this chapter. Remember that? Remember the process of knowledge? Anybody remember one of the processes of knowledge? Without looking back. What are the process? Remember we talked about that last week? How materially people say you get knowledge by being very intelligent and studying. And how does Krishna say you get knowledge? Yes, certainly by him giving it to you, but what is the process you do to invoke that? You can get it wrong. I'd rather you try and get it wrong than that you don't try at all. Okay. Which he describes in that 8 through 12 as? Yeah, well, he doesn't give the processes, but he just gives a general. He says, okay, good. Studying what becoming the nature of the problems of birth, death, old age, and disease. Remember we talked about that? Mm-hmm. The one had to learn. Okay, good. The nine processes just said ananya bhakti, pure bhakti. What else? What was the most important thing in that list? Do you remember? Without looking back. This is something important that one should know to say, I know Bhagavad Gita. All right, I'll look back. 8 to 12. Look at 8 to 12. This thing said it had plenty of battery life this morning, and now it shows that it's almost dead. No, batteries. Do you guys have any extra AA batteries? I need two. It might survive for the rest of this time, but I checked it.
It said it had plenty, and now it's saying it's almost dead. Oh, look at that. Okay. Hopefully I won't need them. But.
Okay. These are recharged. Are these charged?
Yeah, they're fully charged.
Fully charged. My son sells these prana bars, and it says, "Are you fully charged?" That's their motto. Okay, what's some of the process of knowledge?
Humility.
Do you remember now? Is it coming back? Okay, and what else? What here is most important? Humility is the beginning, and what's most important? Approaching a bona fide spiritual master and engaging, as you were pointing out, in unalloyed devotional service. Yes?
Perception of the evil of
birth, death, old age, and disease. We talked about non-attachment to family. Remember we talked about that? How that doesn't mean you shouldn't be affectionate. Do you remember? Is that starting? You weren't here. But for the rest of you, is that starting to come back? Are you remembering how we talked about one should still be affectionate to one's husband and children? You shouldn't be mean to them. This verse doesn't mean you should be mean to them. Okay. All right. So 8 to 12 describes how you get knowledge. There's the knower. Who's the knower? I'm the knower. Okay. 8 to 12 is how do you get knowledge? Material society said you get knowledge by having a high IQ and going to school and studying hard. And then what is there to be known? What is there to be known? What are you trying to know?
Krishna.
You're trying to know Krishna and yourself. So the knower, the process of knowledge, and the known. I'm the knower. Process of knowledge is, someone tell me something from the process of knowledge without looking. Humility. What else? Approaching a bona fide spiritual master. Something else without looking.
Cleanliness.
Something else without looking. Detachment from the general mass of people. Remember we talked about television? You weren't here. Uh-huh. Somebody remember we talked about television. I think Sefer Mitzvah asked the question. Right? All right? Okay. Coming back. Okay. And what is there to be known? What are we trying to know? Krishna and ourself. Okay. And that was something that Arjuna asked in the beginning of this chapter. Remember he had his questions, what's kshetragya, what's prakriti, what's purusha? And then he also asked, what is jnana? Jnana gyam, chakeshava. What is, jnana means knowledge, gyam means the goal of knowledge. So sometimes people out in the world say, we're gaining knowledge to gain knowledge. You have some goal, something you're trying to understand. So Prabhupada says here in this purport that some people says that in perfection, these all become one. But that's not true. So even in perfection, there's me, there's Krishna, and there's the process of knowing him. Okay? What happens when I get to know Krishna? I'll know everything else. That doesn't necessarily mean I'll know how to fix a flat tire. Sometimes we think like that. A pure devotee should know the population of Algeria. It should be omniscient, like God. What happens when I know Krishna? I become fearless. Oh, absolutely. What else? I'll know everything. I'll become fearless. What else?
Peaceful.
I'll be definitely peaceful.
Happy.
Definitely happy.
And at the end, you go back home.
At the end, I'll go back home. Why? Because if I know Krishna, I will
serve him.
Because I will feel
love.
Wow. Now, in this world, sometimes the more I know somebody, the more I don't want to be around them. Isn't it? This devotee just sent me an email. So-and-so, I think it's her parents, are suggesting I marry so-and-so, and I don't even want to know anything about him. I don't even want to see his picture. And I thought, that's not very smart. So in this world, sometimes the more you get to know somebody, the more you don't like them. Sometimes you meet someone and you think they're very nice, and then you get to know them and you find out that they're a cheater. Right? Has that ever happened? With Krishna, the more you get to know him, the more you like him. So this relationship between the lover and the beloved, there's three things. There's the lover, us, love, which is the relationship, and the beloved, which is Krishna. Or the knower, the process of knowledge, and the known. And Prabhupada also makes a nice point here. He says, knowledge is nothing but the preliminary stage of understanding devotional service perfectly. Knowledge is nothing but the preliminary stage of understanding devotional service perfectly. Again, why? Because when I know Krishna, I will serve him. Why will I serve him? Because I'll love him. And when I serve in this world, it's not usually out of love. It's usually out of a calculation. And honestly, even people who are in love, there's some calculation there. I was just reading in Krishna book, the prayers of Krishna's queens. They're staying up all night talking in madness to the mountains and the rivers and the birds. And they're talking to the rivers and saying, I think you've dried up because you're not getting any rainwater from the ocean through the clouds. And Prabhupada says, a husband who doesn't take care of his wife financially, she dries up. So even if a woman says, I love this man, she's usually calculating, and she probably should. Is he able to maintain me? You know, if you just think, well, I love this guy, and never mind that he's just living on the dole, and he's a drug addict, and, you know. People do that, don't they? Mm-hmm. Oh, I love him. Can he take care of you? I don't know. I just love him. So there is some intelligence to having some calculation in this world. But in this world, we don't just serve people because we love them. We serve people because we're calculating. I'll serve this man and he'll be able to take care of me. He'll love me back. He'll give me a nice home. He'll provide for me. He'll be a good father to our children. Or I'm going to work for this company because they have a good, you know, retirement package or good medical care or whatever it is. Nice working conditions. Generally, it's like that. So with Krishna, you know him and you just want to serve him out of love. Not calculating. Not thinking, well, like we gave all the wonderful things that will happen. We'll become peaceful. We'll become happy. We'll become fearless. But the pure devotees, actually, they don't even care about that. They don't care if they become happy and fearless or peaceful. In fact, some of the very pure devotees in the Vrindavan mood, they're not very peaceful. They're having spiritual anxieties. Krishna's wrapped up in the big Kaliya snake and he might die. Oh my, what's going to happen? Indra's pouring rain. All of Vrindavan will be flooded. Krishna's cows will be killed. What will happen? Mother Yasoda is thinking, you know, Krishna might fall in the Jamuna and die, and he might get burned by the fire. It says she was not very peaceful. So they're, you know, on the highest platform, they're not even thinking like that. They're just thinking, I love him so much. And we see that madness in this world, again. We especially see it between men and women. But you see it with people for their country, too. I'm just going to serve my country, my fatherland, my motherland, and, you know, they go and do all kinds of crazy, horrible things to serve their country. Don't we see that? You don't see it so much with businesses anymore. It used to be people were loyal to a certain company for their whole life. But you certainly see it between men and women. Oh, I love her. She's cheating on you. I don't care. I just love her. I'll follow her anywhere, whatever she does.
So we ultimately, one feels like this about Krishna. So therefore, knowledge is the preliminary stage of understanding devotional service perfectly. We cannot love and serve Krishna unless we know him. We cannot love and serve Krishna unless we know him. Therefore, we need to study philosophy. So there are sometimes people who say, oh, we'll just love Krishna. We won't study Bhagavad Gita. We won't study the cantos of the Bhagavatam about creation. We'll just study Krishna eating butter, or Krishna, usually they want to just study Krishna dancing with the gopis, you know, and we'll just love Krishna. But how can you love somebody you don't know? You can't. Which is one of the main reasons why in the early stages of Krishna consciousness, it's hard to feel that love for Krishna. Because we don't know him. I can't love just an idea. I have to love somebody that I know. And once you love Krishna, of course you want to hear about him. The great pure devotees, they love hearing the Bhagavad Gita. And they love hearing how Krishna is creating the world. Anything about Krishna. So if I want to fall in love with Krishna, I have to know about him. And once I love Krishna, I enjoy knowing about him. Don't you like knowing about people you love? Of course you do. Right? It's natural. Okay. Going on to text 20. This is one of those places which is over and over again, that we are also, that not only is material nature, but the soul is also part of Krishna. We're also an expansion of Krishna. There's Swamsa and Vibhinamsa. So Krishna expands as Swamsa and Vishnu forms, and Vibhinamsa is a living entity. So we're also expansions of Krishna. Or sometimes we're taken as Krishna's energy. Now here Prabhupada says that both material nature and living entities are eternal. That is to say, they existed before the creation. So neither material nature nor the living entities are ever created. In fact, nothing is ever created. Albert Einstein said this. He said, matter and energy are never created or ever destroyed. Matter can turn into energy and energy can turn into matter, he said, but nothing is ever created or destroyed. So we would agree with that. And we wouldn't agree with some Christian philosophers who say that God created everything out of nothing, that first there was nothing. And of course the evolutionists say something sort of in the middle. They talk about that everything was created from a chunk that was infinitely small and infinitely dense. You know, dense means packed up. So first of all, how can something be infinitely small? And how can something infinitely small be infinitely dense? Immediately you're talking about something supernatural. Right? Is that within nature, something infinitely small and infinitely dense? No, they're talking about God, who's Anantarastha Paramanu Jayantarastham, who's the smallest of the smallest, and yet within him are all the universes. That's a nice description of Krishna, that which is infinite, he who is infinitely small yet infinitely dense. But they're saying that it's matter, and that this matter exploded, and from this explosion came suns and moons and planets and giraffes and coconut trees, etc. Which is a pretty supernatural explanation. You know, then they want to criticize religious people. Oh, you believe in fantastic stories in your scriptures. And my answer is, well, you're telling us a pretty fantastic story too. This infinitely small, infinitely dense thing exploded and created, you know, the Pacific Ocean and Pukiko birds. That's a pretty fantastic story. So we neither say that God created everything out of nothing, nor do we give some imaginative fantastic story. We say everything's always existed. Sometimes it's manifested, and sometimes it's not manifested. And of course, material nature is always changing its form. Manifested, not manifested. It's just like all of us have, Prabhupada gives this example, all of us have anger. Now, right now, none of us, I think, are manifesting our anger. But it's there. It's not that it's not there. And how fast could it take us to manifest that anger? Like that, right? Haven't you gone from being not angry to being angry in a tenth of a second? So it's there. It's not that anger has been created when we become angry. Does that make sense? It's always there. Sometimes it's not manifest. All right, then Prabhupada says here, the living entities are also in him, but because they are conditioned, they are averse to serving the Supreme Lord. So averse to serving the Supreme Lord. We don't like to serve him. Thus they are not allowed to enter into the spiritual sky. So just like you wouldn't have someone live here in the loft who was averse to doing service here. Of course not. What to speak of if somebody came here and said, you know, I'm really God, and everyone here should listen to me. You know, you wouldn't even let them visit, right? You'd say, sorry, you're causing a disturbance. Please leave. So because we're averse to serving Krishna, by the way, actually admitting that we are averse to serving Krishna takes a tremendous amount of humility. So we may say that in the Hare Krishna movement, yes, we're averse to serving Krishna. But to believe that that is our problem takes a lot of humility and usually a lot of years of chanting Hare Krishna. But with the coming forth of material nature, these living entities are again given a chance to act in the material world and prepare themselves to enter into the spiritual world. That is the mystery of the material creation. So the mystery of the material creation is that the material creation is both for sense gratification and for liberation at the same time. It has both functions. That's its mystery. And this question was asked by Maharaj Pariksit in the 10th canto. This is in the prayers of the personified Vedas. He said, how can we approach Krishna with material senses? And we even say, Dasya Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Grahamindriya. You can't perceive Krishna with your material senses. So why are you saying we should be chanting and worshiping the deity and offering our food and reading these books? I mean, this book looks like paper and ink to me. Doesn't it look like paper ink to you? And I'm speaking with, you know, what's in my mouth? It's just blood and flesh and fat. How am I approaching Krishna with that? So Prabhupada said that is the mystery of the material creation, that it's meant for both purposes. It's meant for both purposes. It's meant both to facilitate our entanglement and to give us liberation. So used in the proper way, we can approach Krishna. And Prabhupada says a really nice thing here. He says, actually, the living entity is originally the spiritual part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, but due to his rebellious nature, he is conditioned within material nature. It really does not matter how these living entities or superior entities of the Supreme Lord have come into contact with material nature. The Supreme Personality of Godhead knows, however, how and why this actually took place. So Prabhupada is saying here that each of us have a story of why we're here. And Prabhupada said here, it doesn't really matter what that story is. He said, of course, Krishna knows the story. Each of us have our own story, which we no longer remember. And Prabhupada said, it's not very important. Sometimes people have big debates over this story. And the crux of the debate is pride. How could I have left Krishna? No way I would have left Krishna. If it was really perfect there, I wouldn't have left. So instead of saying I was stupid enough to leave a perfect place, we say it couldn't have been a perfect place. There must be something wrong with Krishna. That is the root of our material disease, my friends. There's something wrong with Krishna. There's something wrong with God. I could be a better God. I could do it better. That's the essence. And then people create their own philosophy. Well, we didn't really fall from Krishna. So Prabhupada says here, it doesn't really matter exactly how we fell. And my understanding is he says that because for most of us, facing that is the most difficult thing that we'll ever do. And really facing that gives us the humility, which is the most essential, or one of the most essential aspects of the process of knowledge. I can't know Krishna without humility. I just can't do it. And this really facing the fact that I'm a rebellious soul who's averse to serving Krishna, and that I am making this decision moment by moment by moment by moment to rebel against Krishna. Not with depression. Not with, oh, I'm such a rebellious soul, I'm so full. That's not useful. If someone offended you, you wouldn't really like that. You ever have anybody do that to you? You know, they offended you and they come and they say, oh, did I offend you? I'm so sorry I offended you. Did I offend you? Are you mad at me? It's just like, oh, be quiet. Isn't it just annoying? So Krishna doesn't want us going, oh no, I'm so depressed. But he does want us to acknowledge. Just like, exactly, you know, if somebody's offended me, I want them to acknowledge it. And I want them to explain how they've offended me. Don't you want that? If someone says, I offended you, I'm really sorry, I'm not very convinced by that. I usually want to say, well, what exactly are you sorry for? What do you think you did? What do you understand that you did wrong? So facing up to this fact, this is the core of what we are doing wrong right now. It's not just something in the distant past, and now I'm a victim. So if I'm not experiencing complete 100% ecstasy, I'm making this mistake at this moment. And therefore you see that the great devotees pray with very deep humility. I am a materialistic rascal, I'm always full of lust. You know, they talk about themselves in this very disparaging way because that's part of their entering into love. But it's not a depressing thing. It's a happy thing. It's a happy thing. It's like you're sitting next to your old friend who you offended, and you're making up the relationship. You're coming together again. Does that make sense? But it's too hard for most of us to face this. So, okay, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just go on. But at some point, one does need to really face it. Say, well, who am I really? What am I really? Ravindasri Prabhu, in one of his blogs, talks about this. And I spoke to him on the phone about it. He said, yeah, I never thought I would chant Hare Krishna and grieve for how I've turned away from Krishna. Nature is the cause of all cause and effects, and I'm the cause of my sufferings and enjoyment. So I'm not really suffering or enjoying because of my circumstances. I'm suffering and enjoying because of my what? Why am I suffering and enjoying? My desire, which has produced activity, which has produced reactions, and because of my attachment. I'm suffering and enjoying because I'm attached and I have this material desires, therefore I've done material activities which have brought me material reactions, and I'm still attached. I wanted to enjoy by getting a big flat screen TV. So I saved my money and I bought it and I brought it home. And it works great. Therefore, I feel happy because I'm attached to enjoying it. Because I was attached to enjoying it, therefore I worked hard to get it. And therefore, when I got it, I felt some happiness from it because I'm attached to it. If I didn't feel any attachment to it, then I either wouldn't have worked hard for it, or when I got it, I wouldn't have cared if it worked or not. It wouldn't have mattered to me. If I visit someone's home, it has a big flat screen TV, doesn't give me any happiness. I don't feel any happiness from looking at it because I don't have any attachment to it. And similarly, if you get it and it breaks, then it's the source of your suffering. Why? Because you're attached. Again, if you told me Mr. Smith down the road just had his huge wall-size flat-screen TV break, I wouldn't feel any suffering because I don't have any attachment. So the living entity is the source of their sufferings and enjoyment. In two ways, that because of our attachment, I've done the activity, I've done the karma, which has given me that circumstance, and because of my continued attachment, I'm trying to get some pleasure out of that. And when I get some pleasure out of that, I call that happiness. And when I don't get some pleasure out of that, I call that suffering. Does that make sense? If I don't have material attachments, I will, first of all, not work for material things. I will not accrue karma. And second of all, whatever things I already have due to my past work, I will not be attached to them. Not attached to them means that they're not the source of my happiness. Not attached doesn't mean I let things break. I don't clean my room. I don't put petrol in the car because I'm not attached. But I'm not thinking this is the source of my happiness. Does that make sense? If I'm thinking, what's the main thing we think is the source of our happiness? This thing, this body, which is the main manifestation of our past desires and attachments. Okay, text 22. Very important verse. Purusha prakriti stohi bhunkte prakriti janguna karanam guna sangosya sadasad yoni janmashu. How does transmigration work? Because we contact certain modes of material nature, what I associate with. And I think of it like you go into a bookstore or one of those movie theaters that's playing 15 different movies. So you go into a bookstore and there's a section of books that are about philosophy. And there's a section of books that are cookbooks. And there's a section of books that are travel books, right? You've all been in a bookstore? Has everybody been in a bookstore in their life? There's a section of books that are horror books. There's romance novels, science fiction. And according to my desire, I go to a certain section of the bookstore. I go to the romance books, or I go to the horror books, or I go to the travel books, or, you know, I go to a certain section. And once I'm in that section, what happens? I start looking at the covers of the books. I start picking up different books and looking at them, and I read them, and this book sounds interesting. And then I buy my book, and I take it home, and I become absorbed in the story. And if I'm really absorbed, I forget everything. I forget that I have to cook dinner, right? Have you ever been really absorbed in a book? Mm-hmm. And you don't even go to sleep. You're still reading the book at 2 in the morning, even though you have to go to work the next day, and you just don't care. How does it end? So that's what we're doing. We're in the material world, and because of my desire, I'm attracted to a particular combination of the modes. And because I'm attracted, then I pay for a particular body, which is like a particular book. And then I become absorbed in that story. That's how it works. And I think that this story is about me. Okay? And what I can do is I can keep reading books from the same section, or I can say, oh, I don't like these horror books anymore. They're too scary. I think I want to read a romance book now. Or I don't want to read these romance books anymore. They're all stupid. I think I want to read a philosophy book. Or these philosophy books are boring. I think I want to read a horror book. So we travel in different lifetimes to the different modes. Sometimes we're attracted to the mode of ignorance. Sometimes to the mode of passion. Sometimes to the mode of goodness. And we go through different lifetimes. Therefore, Prabhupada says, under the influence of material desire, the living entity is born sometimes as a demigod, sometimes as a man, sometimes as a beast, as a bird, as a worm, as an aquatic, as a saintly man, as a bug. And in all cases, a living entity thinks himself to be the master of circumstances, yet he is under the influence of material nature. Under the influence of material nature, just like you're reading the book. You're under the influence of the author of the book, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Or with a movie, you know, you go, which movie do I want to watch? And once you're in that seat, you're under the influence of the director of that movie. But you're thinking, yes, this great adventure book, you know. But you're thinking, I'm the master of the circumstances. And sometimes you read a book where, you know, you're identifying with a saintly person, and sometimes with a bug, and sometimes with a, right? With a demigod. What does Prabhupada mean here as a saintly man, do you think? When he gives this list, demigod, man, beast, bird, worm, aquatic, saintly man, and bug. Yeah, higher planetary systems. Or someone seen as very saintly. I think about someone like Gandhi or Mother Teresa, who people think of as very, very saintly. I mean, how saintly are you if you're feeding dead cows to people? You know, so that's a lifetime as a saintly person. Someone who's doing good in the world, who's religious, and so forth. And here it says, one has to rise, therefore, above the three material modes and be situated in the transcendental position that is called Krishna consciousness. Unless one is situated in Krishna consciousness, his material consciousness will oblige him to transfer from one body to another because he has material desires since time immemorial. But he has to change that conception. That change can be affected only by hearing from authoritative sources. So note here, and we were talking about this on Sunday in the Nectar of Instruction, the key is consciousness. The key is consciousness. The mind, our heart. All of the activities we do are meant to bring us to the proper consciousness, upon which time we'll do those activities because we have the proper consciousness. Just like I said, if you read about Krishna, you'll fall in love with him. And once you fall in love with him, you'll want to read about him. So the reason we're chanting 16 rounds, the reason we're waking up early, the reason we're having kirtan, the reason we're offering our food, is so we can change our consciousness. And once we change our consciousness, we'll naturally want to offer our food and chant 16 rounds and go out and distribute books. Well, it will be an effect. So it's both the way that we change our consciousness and the symptom of our consciousness being changed. But the key is to change the consciousness. The key is not the activities. Does that make sense to all of you? Don't think Krishna consciousness is just what I'm doing with my body. That what I'm doing with my body should be affecting my mentality. Okay. If he submits to this hearing process, the living entity will lose his long-cherished desire to dominate material nature, and gradually and proportionately, as he reduces his long desire to dominate, he comes to enjoy spiritual happiness. All right, so the idea is that when I'm hearing this, I start thinking, this desire I have to dominate the material world is a foolish desire. It's causing me pain. We gradually become more and more and more convinced of that. And the impersonalist idea is that first I get rid of all my material desires. I make my material desires zero. Then after I make my material desire zero, then I can develop spiritually. And we talked about that in chapter 5, how difficult that is. So our process is very different. Our process is my spiritual desires. I start out with my spiritual desires almost at nothing, and my material desires are way here. And Prabhupada says here that gradually and proportionally as he reduces his long desire to dominate, he comes to enjoy spiritual happiness. So it's going like this. As my material desires are going down, my spiritual desires are going up. It's going like this. It's not that it goes down and then I get to zero and then I get spiritual desires. That's not our process. That's the impersonalist process. And the impersonalist process is difficult because it's very difficult to just make your desire zero and have no desires. And once you have zero desires, it's hard to fall in love with Krishna because you've stopped everything. That was Bhagavad Gita 12.5. So we're trying to take as my spiritual desires go up, my material desires go down, and as my material desires go down, my spiritual desires go up. They're working in tandem. And I do this here, Prabhupada says, especially by hearing. I start hearing how wonderful Krishna is. I think, wow, I'd really like to serve Krishna. I'd really like to be in Goloka Vrindavan. Yeah, that sounds fun. Going out with Krishna and herding the cows and dancing with Krishna and feeding Krishna butter. And that sounds like a lot of fun. I think I'd like to do that. And we gradually have, and we start thinking, you know, this desire to enjoy this world really isn't working out very well. It's not really giving me the kind of happiness that I seek. No. I think I'd like to get rid of that. Okay. A And here, of course, Krishna is saying that besides the soul, there's also the super soul. And Prabhupada says the Lord is always eager to take him back to the spiritual world, to the spiritual energy, but due to his minute independence, the individual entity is continually rejecting the association of spiritual light. This misuse of independence is the cause of his material strife in the conditioned nature. So although Prabhupada said we don't really, it's not important how we came here, he's telling us we misuse our independence. And he says we are continually rejecting the association of spiritual life. Continually. That means it's something going, continuously means it doesn't have a break. Continually means it goes on with breaks. So at least for those of us in Krishna consciousness movement, we have some times where we're not rejecting spiritual light. Where we're saying, yes, I will take the spiritual light. But if we're still conditioned souls, that means we are continually rejecting the spiritual light due to the misuse of our independence. Again, taking that fact into the heart and accepting it, that is the essence of real humility. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. It's extremely difficult to do. And until and unless we've done that, we will not be steady in devotional service. I did not talk about this last Sunday when I talked about Shraddha Prema, but the door between unsteady devotional service and steady devotional service is humility. That's the end, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his Bhajana Rahasya. That's the difference between someone who's unsteady and someone who's steady. And steadiness, which we'll read in the next chapter, Mamchayo Vyavicharina. What word would you like me to explain? What word did you not understand?
Sorry.
No, just tell me, what word?
Yeah, no, I was looking for, because I have a question.
Oh, okay.
I was looking for after.
Oh, okay. Can you say the word in Spanish to your sister? Maybe she'll know.
Yeah, okay.
Just now. What is the word? What did you want to say?
It's because a chance. Not only a chance. No, it's not here. But
another place. It says, by chance we have fallen.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's in the next.
Yes. Okay. Good. That's a good question.
Because I don't understand one part. That takes
okay. Well, we can do that right now. Because Prabhupada does say in one of these purports, by chance we have fallen.
Yeah.
So how does he say? First he says it's misuse of our independence. And he also says by chance.
Yeah, I don't
understand. Okay. So, just like, let's say a person decides to smoke. So, most people are not born smoking. Maybe you are if your mother smokes and there's lots of smoke in the house, but generally we're born with healthy lungs, and a desire to smoke is not part of our physiology. We have a physiological, bodily desire to have food, to have water, to have physical affection. You know, babies who never get anybody holding them will die. Did you know that? We have physical urge for sex. We have physical urge for proper temperature and some comfort. Those are physical urges of the body, right? But we don't have a physical urge for smoking. That's not part of our body. So why do people smoke? Why do they smoke? Social. It's a choice. But does it also happen because of circumstances?
Mm-hmm.
Both. So it's a choice. It's definitely a choice. But you could also say by chance, by circumstances. Does that make some sense to you?
Yeah.
You know, somebody at school offered them a cigarette and they took it. It was still their choice. And at least I'm sure here in New Zealand, people are educated that cigarettes is going to make you sick and kill you. So a person knows that, But they're thinking, it won't happen to me. Other people will get cancer and emphysema, but not me. But you could also say by chance. That you could also say. By circumstances. But that doesn't mean that they're a victim. Because many people are in those circumstances and don't choose to smoke. The circumstances don't dictate that you're going to smoke. So, of course, we have to have the opportunity to leave Krishna. Otherwise, there's no love. I was talking to this lady once who was very angry at her husband. She said, I'm forced to stay in this relationship. I said, no, you're not. How are you forced? I said, you can leave. She said, well, I'm not supposed to leave. I said, that's another discussion. But you have the ability to leave. No one's chaining you in the house. Without the ability to leave, there's no love. Therefore, we often say to people, are you doing this because you want to? If someone's doing a favor for us, we want to know, are you doing this favor because you want to do it for me, or do you feel obligated? Isn't that one of our questions? Especially women tend to ask that question. We want to know that people are doing something for us voluntarily. So volunteer means you can leave. Therefore, the option must always be there. Anyway, I take that as the kindness of the great devotees, that they say, oh, by chance.
But also it's a process, like
is there a process of leaving?
Yeah.
Of course. As you go on chanting Hare Krishna, you'll see that process happening, as Prabhupada says here, continually in your own heart. Again, that's not just some process in the past. It's a process that's going on continually. How do we turn away from Krishna? How do we reject Krishna? Definitely. There's a process for how one becomes entangled, and there's a process for how one becomes liberated. And it's the reverse. Have I given you guys my class on that with chanting? Mm-hmm. Never done that. I think it was a long time ago.
Yes.
Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj explains this, and we could have the class again sometime. Maybe we'll do it with a big group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. How our original desire gradually entangles us, and how we can reverse that process through Krishna consciousness. It's definitely a process. And many places, especially in the Bhagavatam, it's given in a summary here in the Bhagavad Gita, especially in this chapter 13 and 14. And more explicitly, especially in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, what is the process by which a living entity becomes entangled? It was a process, it was gradual. Again, somebody doesn't pick up one cigarette and take one puff and then fall over from cancer. That doesn't happen. It's a process. They take one smoke and then they take more and then they become addicted and it becomes a habit and then gradually their body becomes ill and so many things. Right? Or I told the story on Sunday of that lady hiker who ended up on the ledge. That was a process. At first, she just deviated a little bit from the path. And she even noticed, I've deviated from the path. And she said, it would have taken me 3 minutes to go back. And she decided, no, I'm not going to go back. And then she kept getting further and further off. And she kept thinking, I'm on the path, I'm on the path, I'm on the path. And then at one time, she realized, hey, I'm way off the path. Then she tries to climb the hill. Then she's totally stuck. So that's a process.
But in that case, yeah, it's a process. It's difficult for me to understand how can be a process and also by chance, you know? It's because it's so
But chance doesn't mean that there's no responsibility. I take it again that the details are not very important. I give you an example. Let's say you have an argument with a good friend, mm-hmm. right? And you see this happens a lot in marriage. The husband and wife will have an argument about something. They'll be arguing about buying a new car, or they'll be arguing about what school they want to send the kid to, or they'll be arguing about how one of them spent their money at the mall yesterday. Okay, they're arguing about something particular, but they're not really arguing about that. What they're really arguing about is, I think you're irresponsible, or I don't think you love me, or I don't really want to listen to you. That's what they're really arguing about. They're not really arguing about, you know, did you spend, I mean, I think I brought this up the other day, you know, how this girl told me, oh, my husband didn't listen to me to refinance the house, and so we're losing money every month. He could have gotten a better deal. And I said, well, do you need more money? No. But it's Krishna's money. I said, okay, did you have something you wanted to do for Krishna with that money? No. I said, maybe you should first think of something, of some service you'd like to do for Krishna with your money. And then, okay, this battery's now dead, so I'm going to stop.